It's here. Debris from the Japan tsunami is blowing up on Alaska shorelines. And if you want, there's apparently a Geiger counter app you can download for your cell phone. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today, an update on what's been seen so far by debris cleanup crews. And what have you seen? Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. It's in the water, it is incoming, and it's the topic on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by the Federal Aviation Administration setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports, faa.gov/go/flyalaska, or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. Every day, over 4,000 infants and toddlers go to sleep in child care programs across Alaska in unsafe cribs. The Alaska Community Foundation is partnering with THREAD to replace unsafe cribs in licensed child care programs across Alaska with new safe cribs. To help, donate today, and the Alaska Community Foundation will provide a one-to-one match of your donation. To donate, visit alaskacf.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, somewhere northeast of Hawaii, a large amount of debris that was released from the coastline of Japan is in the water and under the water and being borne by ocean currents at a speed of about 6 miles a day in our direction being somewhere in the Western Hemisphere, somewhere on the West Coast in South America or North America, and quite possibly Alaska, if you believe the study by Ian Miller of Sea Grant, it could be quite a bit of it will be coming north. It basically gets to a point where it splits. It either goes south or north, and we'll just find out. But in the meantime, because of winds, anything that stuck up out of the water and presented a profile to wind, especially if it was light, already made it to the coast, a lot of it. And that's one of the things we're going to be talking about today. And we have a couple of terrific experts for you to discuss this with. And our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. I guess we will start with, actually, Dave Gaudette of the Marine Debris Program of the Marine Conservation Foundation. Marine Conservation Foundation was basically set up by the fishing industry and has been cleaning up Alaska shorelines for years now, and there's been plenty to clean up. So so Dave, was this, did this Fukushima thing end up prompting a whole lot more activity, basically, by your organization?
Well, it prompted a lot of activity beginning last December and January when rumors of objects began to come our way. We got a lot of phone calls that things were starting to show up, and then we responded by starting a monitoring program. And so, yeah, it did. It generated a lot of activity to see if there's anything out there, but it hasn't generated a lot of activity to clean anything up yet.
Yeah. And also with me is Peter Murphy. He is the Alaska Regional Coordinator of the Marine Debris Program of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Peter, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Oh, thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
I think Dave highlighted something that we probably need to go back to, which is that there's always stuff washing up on the beaches.
Yeah, no, it's a very valid point. You know, marine debris has been an issue for many years, and especially in the state of Alaska, where currents and winds tend to bring a lot of debris from the open ocean to Alaskan shores. You do get higher deposition of debris in Alaska, and something that a lot of groups, including MCAF, have been working on for many years. There are a lot of there's a pretty significant and innovative marine debris community in Alaska already that's been dealing with this issue.
So the how is it being tracked, Peter? If is remote sensing being used to kind of look for incoming debris that's borne by currents?
It's a good question, and certainly it's one, you know.
Yeah, all you really have to do,
looking out
you,
in the open ocean,
don't you
for
just
what's
coming. Don't you just you just put a Geiger counter in orbit and it's all taken care of?
Right. We can get to the radiation thing in a little bit, but absolutely, remote sensing has certainly been part of what we've been trying to do. So actually, using high-resolution satellites to look out in the open ocean, because right after the event, so I mean the days right afterwards, you could actually see the debris in big bands, kind of islands of debris off the coast of Japan. But those quickly dissipated. So within a few weeks, it was too spread out, sea debris with that resolution of satellite. So now we're looking with higher resolution satellites across the Pacific. But even then, it's hard to find the debris because it just presents a small target. You're talking about individual pieces of debris that are relatively small. And so that's something that we're working on. But the other element of that is, since sometimes it's a big ocean that you're looking at, we're working with people from the fishing fleets, the shipping fleets, government fleets, Coast Guard, Navy, as well as just recreational boaters to report in what they see opportunistically, since we really need as many eyes out there as we can get. And we've gotten over 1,300 reports of potential debris out in both the ocean and on shoreline of potential tsunami debris. So that's been invaluable to have people out there with their eyes and ears in addition to the targeted approaches we're using.
Well, what do you have, like a situation room in there where you, I picture some kind of giant wall display whatever the equivalent is, push pins is nowadays, stuck in, citing this and such a date and so forth.
Well, actually, that's you know, we're using kind of the digital equivalent of push pins.
Yeah.
So we receive the reports in by email and then enter it into a tracking database. And then from that, we do put them on a map. We put yellow push pins for objects that could be from the tsunami, and then red ones for ones we're able to confirm, so actually go back and be able to say, definitely this came from the tsunami. And we put those up on a map that we update on our website. So you can actually see the results of that, where all the sightings are coming in, both over the whole Pacific and then in the individual states on our website. So we do put that up, and there's not a war room like you would see in in one of the disaster films, but certainly we do get together and talk it through and see what the trends are and how that might influence both our inform our modeling efforts and also our tracking efforts.
And that website would be the marinedebris.noaa.gov?
Exactly. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. Yeah, marinedebris.noaa.gov. On the left-hand side, there's just a Japan Tsunami Marine Debris button, and in there you can see our modeling data, the sightings data, and also the monitoring data.
Yeah, it is actually kind of fun, and I guess gets updated rather frequently.
Yeah, we shoot for once a week to update that. We're always getting reports in, you know, on a daily basis, and so we try to update the maps on try for a weekly basis to get those up to date and so that people can see what people are reporting in and how it's spread out.
Well, there's been a policy fuss about where the money's going to come from to respond to this, and of course our own congressional delegation in Alaska has been active in this. And the main thing is that there's not much money. As I understand it, NOAA has something in the tens of thousands of dollars, which sounds absolutely ridiculous.
Well, we have given out of our program from our existing base budget. We were able to take and locate about $50,000 or exactly $50,000 per state. But that's coming out of our existing base budget. And so that's what we've been able to do. We understand, you know, more resources are going to be needed, and so that's why we're working with the different groups to understand, you know, what's out there and what can be done. But it is certainly a challenge in that there is these costs can be quite high. Removing one vessel, which actually Dave can talk about more than I can, but one vessel from the Pribilof Islands, you know, took a significant amount of money just to remove that one vessel during an individual project back in 2010. So the cost can be quite high for marine debris removal, especially in Alaska where things are more remote.
How do you coordinate with the Canadian side?
That's a really good question. So we've reached out to both the BC government, so at the provincial level, you know, it's obviously province instead of state, and so they have their own kind of working group and working team. So we work with them just to exchange information, what they're up to, what we're finding, what they're finding, and then also we've had their coordinating with their own federal groups as well. But a lot of it is happening at the provincial level within Canada. But they're actually putting out that disaster debris at NOAA.gov. That's the email address where we receive reports. And so we're actually getting the reports from BC and then passing them back on to them. So that way, that was just an easier way to do it as opposed to trying to set up multiple methods.
So there was this big old floating dock that came ashore in BC, and there was also, as I understand it, two others that they knew had gotten loose and would probably show up somewhere. I understand that at least one of them has been found someplace north of Molokai and mm-hmm. still floating. And do we know where the third one is yet?
No, we don't. The reports we've received are, the one that you mentioned in Oregon, and then one was sighted off of Molokai, last sighted on September 19th. So they've been working to reacquire that dock. So that's two. From what we understand, working with the Japanese consulates and Japanese contacts about the docks, they believe there were four from that location, one of which actually floated back onto Japanese shoreline, and that's at least one additional. But there haven't been sightings of that dock.
Now, is there an invasive species concern with those docks? I know that the one, Oregon, I thought it was BC, but it's Oregon. The one that came ashore, they were nervous about that, and there were also seemed to be quite a lot of fauna on the boat that came ashore in BC.
Yeah, invasive species are certainly something that have been an emerging concern, and it takes a certain type of debris object to have that threat. So an object that was just kind of on shore on dry land, and then the wave came, a tsunami wave came in and pulled it offshore, and then it began its journey across the Pacific. That object's not going to have had time in the coastal zone to get different kind of local species from Japan and growing on it that then could survive the journey. So it's really just going to pick up stuff in transit. It takes an object that actually is sitting in the marine environment near shore in Japan, and then is torn loose, so actually has local things built up on it. So that's why the dock is an example of something where there is that concern. A dock, a small vessel that had been moored or left unattended. Those are the type of objects that could be vectors for, as they call them, just means of transport for invasive species.
So that would add to the cost of treatment and responding, I would think.
Yeah, that is something, and there's actually a separate working group that we're working with, but across the states, there's folks from individual states, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, California, Hawaii, that are working together on sort of how to actually coordinate the reporting and handling of the invasive species issue, because it would add to the cost and something you have to keep in mind, but not every object is going to have that threat. So it's important to be able to identify them and kind of have clues of what to look for.
Thanks. We're talking with Peter Murphy of the Marine Debris Program of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and also with Dave Gaudette, who runs the Marine Conservation Foundation's Marine Debris Program. And Dave, where's the money coming from your the survey that you've been responsible for?
Well, there were two surveys. There was a survey, or as we call it, a monitoring program that we did last winter. What we did was we've been working since 2003 and cleanup projects throughout Alaska, and we had some experienced contractors in Craig, Sitka, Yakutat, and Kodiak, and we had them go down and to the beaches that they knew well once a week or whenever they could. Our winter weather, of course, is not that good, and so it turned out to be whenever they could. And they went and looked at the beaches to see if there was anything unusual. These people have been on the beaches a lot, and so they know when there's something different. So we had that monitoring program, and that continued until May. And then in May, we wrote along with, it was Tim Veenstra of Airborne Technologies Incorporated out of Wasilla, and I. We wrote a proposal, or Tim wrote it mostly, but to do a systematic airborne survey of the coast. And we were unable to find funding for it, but the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation found funding, and they went ahead and they conducted a aerial survey throughout the summer, all the way from Cape Muson at tip of southern and southeast, all the way out as far as Halo Bay on the Alaska Peninsula.
Wow. And so those results are out now.
They're not out yet. as everybody who lives in Alaska knows what kind of summer we had.
Yeah.
We thought that we were going to be able to, or that the aerial survey was going to be able to be completed quite quickly, and unfortunately, the weather was just as worse as it could be, and it took a long, long time to complete the survey. And I think finally around September 8th or 10th, we finally deemed it to be, or Tim finally deemed it to be finished. And ATI has been in the process of working with DEC and Peter and myself to try and organize the data. And the beauty of their data is that they have one person looking at all these different concentrations and then trying to rate those as to, on a scale of 1 to 5 as to how bad it is.
And can you generally characterize? I mean, I understand we have seen some like styrofoam foam, and we've seen a lot of these floats. Aquaculture floats and stuff like that.
That's correct. As you were mentioning earlier, what we've really seen right now has been the high windage objects, and those have been the floats, the styrofoam. There's been a lot of styrofoam, and then there's been a lot of what they call the oyster buoys, these black, hard plastic buoys that are about 3 feet tall, maybe 16, 18 inches in diameter, and those are a lot of those that have shown up. Of course, you would expect that they would show up. They'd be right up on top of the surface. They'd be subject to the winds and the winter storms that we had, and that's what we saw. The other interesting thing that I found was that because these buoys were picked up in the harbor areas, they had no lines attached, and so they had no drag whatsoever. They were just able to get up and roll on top of the waves. The other thing that we've seen, though, is we've seen styrofoam from construction, and we've seen some styrofoam from refrigerators. Oddly enough, those will, as heavily insulated as they are, parts of them tend to float.
Refrigerators. Floating refrigerators.
I think there's in this instance, I mean, just another example of that is the motorcycle that showed up in British Columbia in the spring. People kind of, the initial thought is, well, wait, a motorcycle, that obviously doesn't float. Well, the motorcycle didn't, but the shipping container was insulated with foam. And so that's another example of, you have kind of these objects that you might not expect, but based on, kind of their the target they present to the wind, their aspects, they actually can move quickly and can be buoyant enough to stay afloat, such as refrigerators and, in this case, an insulated container.
Dave Gaudette, we got a call for you, or email for you from a class in the fifth grade at Craig, and they wanted to know if you're coming to Craig. But I guess you have a contractor there, right?
Yes, we do. We have a contractor, Kathy Peavy, down there with has been working for us since 2009.
And they also want to know what type of debris do you expect to come in next? So I guess we'll throw that to Peter Murphy.
Well, I think that's sort of the question. I think that we would expect that you'd still continue to see some high windage debris because, some of it came ashore, but potentially not all of it. Some of it didn't make it ashore before kind of the season shifted, and I still have that. And then also potentially more of the kind of lower windage debris, so stuff that sits a little bit lower in the water. And that kind of brings up one of the questions of this is, we know that the tsunami released a lot of debris that's a lot of different types, from everything from lumber debris, from houses and such, to the buoys and the styrofoam. But the distribution of that, how much styrofoam, how much, we don't have that exact information. So, we kind of anticipate that some of that lower windage or middle windage objects could be coming ashore. But exactly how much is left out in the open ocean is something that's still an open question. Part of the why, as you mentioned earlier, trying to look for it out in the open ocean to see what we can find and see what's out there.
Speaking of Kathy Peavy down in Craig area, she says, my question to both of you is, how do you explain to people that not every piece of debris with Japanese writing is related to the tsunami? I like to say we have historical Japanese marine debris, but lately everybody's bringing in Top Ramen labels to me, and I don't know what to say to convince them that it might not be tsunami debris. What do you say to the general public about how to identify if the debris is related to the tsunami?
Well, it's actually almost impossible to do that. As I said, Kathy's been doing marine debris cleanups for us for a long time. She's also, she had done them before we had worked with her, and she's collected material off the beaches. And she's well aware, like all the people that have been on the beaches, that we have been getting a steady influx of debris from Japan or Japanese vessels for years. So telling how one came from the tsunami, well, there's been some telltale ones. Of course, there's been the soccer ball that showed up on Middleton Island. And Kathy Peavy was somebody that was working with her, was able to find a basketball that was also labeled from one of the schools. And, of course, the motorcycle that Peter referred to was identified by the owner in Japan. So anyway, yeah, you can. That's really the only way. Other than that, we've always gotten some debris from Japan.
Yeah, I think to kind of build off of that, I know one of the first cleanups I went on was up in Norton Sound, and that was back in 2009. So, you know, obviously well before the tsunami, and there were water bottles from a lot of, you know, with different foreign languages on them, different Asian languages. You know, not a linguist, so I wouldn't hazard a guess as to exactly which ones they were, but, you know, that speaks to, you know, even up there, up further north in the Bering, you had foreign debris, and so it does happen every year.
Yeah.
Identifying individual stuff, you know, you really do need kind of a fingerprint, something like a registration or specific information, but you can also hopefully try to tell by the changes in, you know, what we're seeing. So Dave pointed out earlier, the fact that there's an unusually large amount of these buoys, styrofoam, even though you can't say that that piece of styrofoam definitely came from the tsunami, it fits the profile of what could be tsunami debris, and it's arriving in that time frame. So,
all right, we get a call from Kenai Venetia. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I had a pretty exciting summer. I fish regularly on the Kasila. I was born up in Fairbanks, and I get to know the beaches, you know, when I go. So for years, I've been going down to Kasila, and I stay about a month, and I got down there late this year. The first day I was there on July the 15th, there were no birds eating any fish eggs. And I thought, okay, don't think nothing of it. The next day, they weren't eating any fish eggs. They didn't eat fish eggs for a couple of weeks. And we watched a few on, like, the 30th of July eating some, but the ones around them weren't. And then a couple of days later, the kids came and got me, and the beach was back to normal for 2 weeks. And I'm sorry I got there late, but 2 weeks, there were no birds, no seagulls eating any fish eggs. I finally got a fish and game officer to come out and document it. And we were pulling out little one-pound fish. We thought they were trout, and we were catching a whole bunch of them. Well, I injured one, so I butchered it. It was a fully loaded adult salmon. I saved two. They looked like reds, but they had the color of silvers, and they fit with their tails and heads off. They fit inside a baggie, a sandwich baggie. So the officer came out, and I guess he did it to shut me up. I quit calling him. You got to come out. It is documented that the fish eggs were just laying on the beach, and the birds were ignoring them, and that was pretty creepy.
It's creepy.
Thanks
and not so, yeah. Thanks for that. It's a very interesting observation. I don't know if we can even speculate as to what might have happened there. Either Dave or Peter have any thoughts on that?
No, I really don't.
That certainly is a very different behavior than you would expect. But yeah.
It's hard telling, Venetia. Were you speculating that maybe there was like a radiation or contamination thing or ecosystem thing? Or?
Well, I don't know. I was looking at them pretty closely. Excuse me if my phone dies. I was looking at everything real closely. The eggs looked normal. The sacs were normal. The organs were normal. The eyes, everything about them were normal. And we only pulled a few, like maybe three or four fish out. That, you know, when they start rotting, they rot from the inside out. And these guys had sores on the outside with no damage under the sore on the inside. So we didn't keep any of those, not even for dog food. Everything looked normal, except they were not eating the eggs. And the other thing we noticed in the last month, me and these three gals, we've counted seven V formations of geese going over, and only one of them was noisy. And we've never heard quiet V formations going over before.
Yeah. I'm wondering, Peter Murphy, maybe you have an answer that answer to this. Is there concern that of what all this styrofoam as it breaks down and, you know, there's all these little fragments of it that maybe it's getting eaten or, you know, that there could be problems with that?
That's a really good question. Actually, we were something Dave and I have been talking about a bit over the past period here is trying to get a sense for that. There have been some studies done, but most of them have been done about the quantity of styrofoam as opposed to the impact further up the chain. So that's something that, you know, there's more work to be done to understand that better. But certainly, you know, we can all agree that having styrofoam on beaches isn't something it's not a good thing. You know, a lot of the research that's been done has been done about, like I said, what kind of exists, the amount that's been there. So something that we're, you know, more to be done, unfortunately.
I have, keeping in touch with the work of oceanographer Ken Bussler at Woods Hole, who has been going out there and sampling the water and sampling the fauna, cobbling up the money from various private sources to keep scientists going and monitoring. And he's specifically looking for radiation. And what he has found is that the radiation has very low. They're very low levels of radiation once you get away from the site. But what he's also found is it is continuing to come out. In other words, the water and everything they use to cool down these fuel rods at the site, you know, is still bringing radiation out into the open ocean. So what's the concern? I mean, it would seem like if it keeps coming out, it's more likely to keep building up in the food chain.
And I think that naturally with the impact on the Fukushima reactor and the, you know, ongoing crisis there, obviously, which, you know, I think it's important to remember is a significant impact to the Japanese people, you know, as we're talking about it on the other side of it. But it's kind of this obvious question of, okay, you know, what's going on with that? It's a natural question I had too. The results from Woods Hole, which Dr. Bussler has showed, as I recall going through them, that, you know, they showed higher levels in kind of the eddies even than had been observed or measured close to shore, but they were underneath any sort of levels of concern. So there haven't been any measurements, since almost immediately after the event that have shown the water levels to have, or water to have radiation levels that are high. I mean, there's a 30 kilometer cord of a monitoring ring around, and I know that as of May of 2011, so just a few months afterwards, that water was passing the levels that it would have passed the radiation levels for drinking water. So certainly seawater, so there are other things you would want to worry about, but as far as radiation goes, that level was quite low. So it's something that certainly there's a lot of effort and attention being paid to keep an eye on it, but there haven't been any indications of anything that is of concern or impact to human health or to species.
And I understand that there's a like with the tuna that they found that basically had been feeding in those waters and then moved all the way across the Pacific, got caught on the Pacific side, on the U.S. side. And they go and sample these fish, and oh my heavens, there's some radiation. It's a small amount. It's not an amount that is considered to be some kind of health risk, but nonetheless, as I understand it, this moves through the fish's system, that they don't actually accumulate this.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we've worked with folks from, you know, both in this case it was an independent study, so you know, wasn't. They have the best data on it, but, you know, different types of radiation that were released, you know, some don't bioaccumulate, like as you said, they move through the systems of the different fish, and others just have a very short half-life, so they already would have decayed in the environment. So, you know, the impacts are forecast to be low, and I think that's the natural thing when you hear radiation detected. That raises an eyebrow. You know, it's logical to think that. But
yeah, but these fish ate up. Yeah, these fish
detected and actually at a level of impact.
Yeah, these fish ate all the way over in Japan, and then they zipped all the way across the Pacific. It is a little surprising.
Impressive.
Yeah, it is. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about tsunami debris with the Alaska Regional Coordinator of the Marine Debris Program for NOAA and the Marine Debris Program Coordinator for Marine Conservation Foundation. And we'll get back to it as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Providence Imaging Center, providing diagnostic mammogram results to patients within one working day, led by Drs. Denise Farley and Heather Tauschik. PROVImaging.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Fukushima tsunami debris, the subject today on Talk of Alaska. And the website over at NOAA, if you want to track it by yourself, is www.marinedebris.noaa.gov. And Peter Murphy of NOAA is with us now. Peter, have there been incidents yet where a vessel has reported just running into something as it's crossing the Pacific?
You know, fortunately, we have not had those reports, or that hasn't happened to date. We have had vessels report in things they've seen, so everything from, you know, a small bit of styrofoam all the way on up to, you know, the dock that showed up off of Molokai recently down in Hawaii, and other, you know, objects of sizes in between. But luckily, nothing has happened. But I think that, you know, is an important point of this, is, you know, those objects that are large could actually have an impact. So we're trying to work with the Coast Guard. We are working with the Coast Guard, I should say, to where, you know, when they see something, they let us know. When we see something or get a report, we let them know so they can put out a broadcast notice to mariners, so people can keep an eye out for these things when they're sighted.
But so far, no real notice to mariners about anything.
No, there haven't. Well, notices to mariners have gone out, but luckily there haven't been any impacts where, you know, a boater has run into something yet. So that's certainly been fortunate and something that we would hope that would continue to be the case. Obviously, safety is the first priority.
Michelle joins the program from Juneau. Michelle, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello, Steve.
Hi. How you doing?
Hi, doing well. Hi, Dave. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Hello, Michelle.
I'm glad you're following up on this. I worked in the spring of this year with the Aleut Corporation and Seward Fishermen to do some surveys out in the Montague region and offshore from Montague and Seward Harbor. And sounds like what we observed was pretty similar to what most folks have been reporting with regards to the high amounts of styrofoam and buoys and such. But we also observed and reported a few other items that were of concern. And I was wondering the extent to which other people are actually identifying any of the species that are attached to confirmed marine debris objects that are associated with the tsunami. Peter, do you have anyone actually working on the taxonomy of the species?
So are you thinking of the in terms of invasive species or potential invasive species?
Right, or even any attached. For example, when I did boat surveys, we did ROV mm-hmm. surveys, and then mm-hmm. helicoptered these beaches, and on several occasions came across the huge number of black buoys that have been reported in a pretty mm-hmm. widespread geographic area in the Gulf. But we also observed the large green buoys that had company stamps on them from the Fukushima region. They still had oysters attached to them. And in some cases, that was the Pacific oyster primarily, the Crassostridagus, the species we cultivate here at our oyster farms. And there was also quite a bit of porphyra often attached to the same buoys, porphyra being the nori or black seaweed. It's cultured in Japan. It's wild in Japan. And, of course, it's the same as our black seaweed that many native cultures collect for food. So we were somewhat concerned about those species in particular, and I was wondering whether either NOAA or MCA or Fish and Game are working to identify any species that are attached to confirmed debris and whether any of those species have emerged as species of concern that may threaten indigenous
Well, there is a group. There is a ad hoc group that is working to collect more information on what's coming over, and there is one person, a representative from Fish and Game, that is in Juneau. Another person is the Sea Grant advisor out of Ketchikan. And there's a person that's involved out of California, and I'm skipping the name. Perhaps Peter can remember the name. But they have been, they are concerned about it. They've put out a lot of information. We have on our website a form that if you do find something, they ask you to take photos or samples or anything else. But, you know, for the most part, my organization, we don't get anything until it hits shore. And then by then it's a completely different, on most of the things like the buoys, they're going to abrade against the sand and the rocks and, you know, quite and dry out. And we don't really get good samples. We don't operate on the water trying to collect any of those. But there is a group that is looking at it. I don't think they're getting very many samples at this point, though.
Mm-hmm. And thus far, then, are there, based upon your knowledge of the species that were associated with the docks or anything coming over, are there any species that you think we should particularly be watching for? Or the fishermen out of Seward and some of other harbors across Alaska are pretty concerned. Is there anything specifically that, I mean, I was a little concerned, certainly, about the porphyra because it's such an important native subsistence food here. Any species that you've seen that might compete specifically with Alaskan species, or is it too early in the game to have any priorities established in that regard?
I'd have to pass that question on to those people that I just mentioned. We have seen our role is merely as trying to facilitate their research. If something comes in that has samples or anything like that on, we pass that on to them. We don't do the analysis ourselves. So if you like, you can contact me later, and I can get you in touch with the people that are trying to catalog that. And I honestly don't know how successful they have been and how many samples they've received to date.
Great. And someone mentioned something we certainly observed, which is there's lots of styrofoam, there's lots of buoys, and with the massive waves crashing on the outer coast, this material is breaking down very rapidly, becoming smaller particles that can be misidentified by juvenile fishes and birds and even invertebrates and ingested. Has anyone looked, done any other stomach content analyses on any smaller nearshore fish to see whether that's occurring, or do you know if there's a plan to look at that in the spring, especially possibly when our young salmon are emerging?
I'm not aware of any program. We certainly agree with you, along with DEC and I'm sure Peter, that the styrofoam is coming ashore and it's just breaking up. The aerial survey that I mentioned before, we've seen where bears have come onto the beach and just taken some of these styrofoam floats and just stomped them and chewed them. And, of course, the result is just little tiny pieces. We've seen some films and photos of styrofoam in the surf with the shorebirds running back and forth. We certainly know that birds are prone to eating plastics, but as Peter was mentioning, I don't think that there's really any studies out there, and I'm not aware of any, that indicate that that styrofoam is one of the major factors. Having said that, you can't help but think what you just said is happening. It's breaking up, and the birds are chasing after it in the small areas. Of course, the fish, the adults came back, adult salmon came back, and they're not very interested in eating. And next year, you're right, there'll be a lot of, there may be a lot of the styrofoam as the juvenile salmon emerge.
Yeah, Michelle, I want to go to 2 points here. The first one is, as for the oyster, the oysters being spotted on these bigger floats, they would not be capable of reproducing in Alaska waters, right?
Well, Steve, that's been the case generally. 99.9% of the time, the cultured Pacific oyster does not reproduce in Alaskan waters, which was a reason it was chosen as a cultivar for our oyster farms. However, there are bays and estuaries where the seawater does rise, and with rising seawater temperatures generally, there's a higher incidence of spawning. So typically that's the case. It's the water's too cold, they don't spawn. However, you land in the right bay and it happens to be a warm August tide series, the water can be sufficiently warm enough for spawning, and that's been documented in Alaska.
Wow. Okay, and the other thing I wanted to toss to Peter Murphy, let's say the Congress decides to put some money to this. Would NOAA be ready with some study plans to get, like, maybe some stomach content data and some other biological work maybe that they'd like to have done, some precautionary things that might be a good idea to put into a plan and hope that it gets funded?
Well, certainly I think that the element of, styrofoam impacts and also, just generally, that's something that, has been identified as an area that could merit further research and would. Future budgets we can't really comment on just because, until they're passed, we don't know what the situation is. So right now we're focused on trying to execute what we can with the funding that exists right now. But we are trying to work with and working with the state of Alaska and the other agencies in Alaska, that have lands and resource management responsibilities to prioritize what to do with the resources that do exist now and, potentially in the future as we find out what the realities are.
Michelle, are you still with us?
I'm still here, Steve.
Okay, anything more?
No, thank you very much.
All right, well, that was very, very interesting about Montague Island, and I guess, Dave, that was kind of one of the hot spots, right?
That's correct, Steve. We actually had one of our contractors was working on Montague Island, and since then he's actually done surveys, and of course it was part of the aerial survey, and it has been one of the hot spots.
Yeah, hot spot was probably not the best choice of language, but sorry.
That's correct. I apologize. It had the heaviest deposition of debris.
Yes, thank you. Let's go to Tom, joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tom.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's my understanding there's about 500 nuclear power plants around the world, and many of them are in coastal areas where tidal waves happen. And I believe that they haven't taken anything to protect the electrical grid. Like a solar flare could take down the electrical grid for years. And then we'd have meltdown in 500 nuclear power plants and many, many problems. I wonder what your group thinks about that.
They may not feel qualified, but we'll see, Tom. And thank you for this. So your idea is that if they weren't able to feed power into the grid, that they'd have to do a bunch of cooling and stuff in order to keep there from being trouble in the reactors. Is that what you're saying?
Right, and it'll be down for years with a solar flare, and we've had some lately that are capable of that. They just went the other direction.
A solar flare would knock out all of our electrical transmission lines?
For years. For years.
Well, how come we haven't had that already?
Well, in 1860, about, there was one that took down the telegraph system, and it took the railroad ties, and it set them on fire.
Whoa!
And in 1920, there was a solar flare that was a real problem and burnt down some power stations, but there weren't many of them. But see, we've never had this problem before because we weren't so dependent on power.
Tom, thanks. I'd love to have you on and have a long conversation on late night radio. I think that would be a whole lot of fun. Peter Murphy or Dave Gaudette, any thoughts on that, the nuclear power plants along the coast?
I'm afraid that's outside my realm of expertise. We dealt solely with marine debris, once it's been in the ocean, trying to prevent it getting in the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call, Tom. And we got one from Debbie in Anchorage who wanted to know if toxins accumulate in animals as they do in humans, can there really be a safe level of radiation? And it's probably good to kind of go through that, because what we have is we have extremely sensitive detection now, I guess you would say. You want to go into that, Peter Murphy?
Yeah, I can certainly. I mean, I think that as we're focused primarily on the marine debris aspects of this, and so as the radiation aspect has certainly been an area of concern, we've worked with a lot of the other agencies to get a better handle on it, but they'd be more qualified to answer this really specifically, but I'll try to get into just kind of the top level of that generally. The detection capabilities that are there now are much more sensitive. So we can detect trace amounts as opposed to danger levels. And so even when these the levels of radiation have been detected in these species. They have been, or in the water, they have been below levels of concern. And also the primary compounds that were released, as we understand it, are ones that have either a short half-life or don't bioaccumulate, so they don't build up in the species. But it's something that we're continuing to work with other agencies that are more versed and more focused on these questions to try to get the best answers and get those out to the public, because it is an ongoing question and one of understandable concern just given the nature. But to this point, you know, the consensus is universal that any impacts are highly, highly unlikely. None have been observed to this point.
Yeah, and Debbie, I would just throw into that there's always been a dispute as to whether there is a threshold at below which radiation is not harmful, ionizing radiation, and that's an ongoing scientific dispute. But this is sort of somewhat besides the point of what we're talking about here, because the amounts that we're talking about here are so small that they're way below background, and so it's really kind of a non-issue at this point, wherever you think the human health concern might be. We got a call from, I love this about talk radio, Dave Gaudette saying the name you were fishing for was Linda McCann.
That's correct. I thought of it after I said that.
So for our listeners, just refresh, she is the person that's trying to do a tracking of what invasive species might be sampled and so forth?
That's correct. And as I said, Fish and Game also has a person, I believe her name is Tammy Davis, in Juneau. And so contacting her or contacting Fish and Game, you can probably find out what is going on, what they've been able to collect, and where they are after they've pooled their data.
All right. It is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about tsunami debris and other stuff that's washing up on the beaches and what's yet to come as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking tsunami debris today, and Patty. Patty is ready to go out there and start picking up that styrofoam herself. And she wants to know where she should bring it. But her question from Kodiak is, tiny pieces of styrofoam have been washing up on Alaska's beaches since last April, early May. And since late April, early May. Here in Kodiak, the pieces are too small to be seen by aerial survey. The larger chunks are caught in high tide grasses and also hard to see. So the question is, will NOAA or DEC or somebody conduct another field survey to get a more accurate picture of what's washing in?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, it's kind of timely in that actually we did do this year. There was a study done by NOAA, National Marine Fisheries Service scientists out of Juneau, but they looked at the outer coast as well as the areas of Yakutat, Kayak, Montague, Middleton Island, Kodiak, and Chirikoff. So kind of a spread across the Gulf of Alaska, and went and actually did on the ground surveys at 87 sites. To get a ground truth, so to say, okay, using the same data form, here's what we saw, here's what was on the ground.
That's a survey
recorded,
I saw, yeah.
And so that way you get kind of an apples-to-apples comparison to say, how does Southeast compare with Kodiak, compare with Kayak? And that actually goes along with what Dave just said earlier, that Kayak, Montague were certainly places where there was a higher debris density, and they noticed the same things of higher styrofoam, higher hard plastics, because in this case we actually had data that went back into the past, so you could actually have a frame of reference to say, here's what it used to be like, here's what it's like now. And actually, there are groups doing that same protocol all throughout the Pacific, so down in Hawaii, on the West Coast, even BC. So that gives us kind of a comparison point to say, here's what the trends are, and here's what the changes are, and they are noticing those same trends. because, like as the caller pointed out, you know, there are things that you can't see from an aerial survey, even a very, very good one as this one was. There's things you just can't see. They're too small on the beach.
So hopefully there will be more.
Yeah, that would be our goal, would be to hopefully try to continue the data as we can. But this will certainly be those combined, that have also the comparison of the aerial survey and what they saw on the ground, will give us a much better picture of where the debris is for this year, and then move towards what to do next year.
I heard that the Japanese government had kicked in $1 million to help deal with debris. Where did that go? What does that run through?
Well, we're still working to get a better sense. I mean, the Japanese government was offered a very generous and humbling gift to the United States to address tsunami debris. But this time, we still don't have all the detailed information of how that money is going to go. It was a total gift of $6 million that included Canada and the United States, as we understand it. But exactly how that breaks down between the different states and how the money is going to flow, we don't know yet. So we're waiting more information, and we'll work to use that however it help out with that however we can, whoever it comes through.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Herman. Joins the program from ENIAC. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Herman. Good to hear from you again.
Yeah, good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to make a couple of observations and a couple of questions. One lady called earlier, she said that they saw these salmon, they're really small, like, you know, and up here in the Kuskokwim, the coho salmon, silver salmon, you know, they're usually like 12 pounds, you know, that derby, you know. And then this year, the winter barely even made 8 pounds, and you could see a lot of the coho salmon are really small, you know. And then I asked somebody who kind of knows what he said, the food out in the ocean has something to do with it, you know. And they also made an observation that those fish they saw on the beach were deformed, like, you know. And I work for Soil and Water Conservation District, and we're studying to see if the practice of communities pumping their sewage lagoons into the estuaries is causing harm, you know. So I was wondering if what they're seeing could be a local cause problem, you know. But I'm kind of concerned about other same thing too, you know. When they have debris coming over from the Japan, it goes in a pile of fish that tend to crack under shade, you know. And if it's emitting radiation, it could be affecting minnows or whatever's in there. But we also had a king salmon problem here. You think that radiation has anything to do with our fish being small or affecting our salmon, or what they were seeing in that place where the fish are deformed, it could be a local problem. So those are my observations. Yeah.
Herman, thank you very much on the Kuskokwim River there. The radiation thing, I guess we'll take that first. Peter Murphy, I guess we'd have to say no evidence that anything, that radiation is doing things to the fish.
No, there's no evidence at this point that we're aware of, but at the same time, certainly, you know, it's an ongoing point of concern. And so I know, you know, FDA and National Marine Fisheries Service, too, are always monitoring and keeping an eye on those testing results. So, as there are any, then they would be getting them out. So, but to this point, we're not aware of any tests that way. So, but it is an ongoing thing to keep an eye on, certainly.
And Dave Gaudette of the Marine Conservation Foundation, it is true that some of that debris is going to be local, isn't it?
Well, that is the case, but by far and away, the majority is not local. But if I could add on to that, when we did the monitoring study in the springtime, we equipped all of our people with Geiger counters, and we did not get one
click
indication that there was any radiation in any of the debris that we saw wash up.
But you gave them the Geiger counters anyway, huh?
We did. We concur with what Peter Murphy had said earlier, that it just doesn't appear that the radiation was going to be a factor, but nonetheless, we didn't want to depend on that. We gave them Geiger counters, and most of those people use them throughout the summer too. But that's debris that's up on the shore that we monitored.
And this one from Katie in Fairbanks. Maybe Peter could talk a bit about marine debris citizen monitoring and education programs that have worked well in Alaska and might provide a model for other Alaska communities?
It's a really good question. I think that, there, as I mentioned earlier in the call, there's in our time today, there's a lot of groups. I mean, MCAF, Gulf Alaska Keeper, that does a lot of work in Prince William Sound, and then Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies in Homer, Island Trails Network out in Kodiak, that do a lot of really good work with both cleanup and then also working with local groups. And a citizen science, I think Dave mentioned earlier, an important element of this is, you know, monitoring programs with the same spreadsheets and, you know, data intensive, all that is very good, and you know, certainly as a science organization, we're in favor of all that. But at the same time, somebody who goes to the beach every day and knows what comes ashore normally, because unfortunately there already is marine debris out there, there is an unfortunate normal level, quote unquote, of marine debris. Somebody like that, you know, they're going to be able to say what's abnormal, you know, what's new, what's unusual. So getting that citizen science in there, Center for Coastal Studies in Homer has done a good job with working with the local community to get people out and survey Kachemak Bay for a long time, which just kind of goes back to that point. If you have a baseline from before, that's even more helpful because then you can see what changed over time. But getting people out, and we encourage people to report in to disaster debris at NOAA.gov, anything they see that is unusual that they think might be tsunami debris, because, you know, that way we can better inform, even if we can't tell exactly, you know, which ones are which. Still, it gives a better picture of, you know, what's arriving where and the trends of it.
Jason and McCarthy, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello. Hey, thanks for taking my call. Following the event, the Fukushima event, since the very beginning back in, I guess, 2010 now. I guess the one thing's on addressing the radiation, first of all, just with some simple searching on the internet, you realize that the bulk of it went up in the steam and the jet stream dosed most North America. And I'm not trying to say that to be alarmist. I wanted to point out more that if you look back in our cultural history, America's been a testbed for radiation, low-dosage radiation for the last 50 years between the above-ground testing and then the continuing development through around the world, both in Russia, China, and you know, France. What's sort of curious in some of the long-term is the insidiousness of the continuing low dosages over large, big dosages. And, you know, it's one of the crazy baselines is if you look at our culture and realize that we're a test bed for, you know, radiation.
Okay,
impact.
Okay, Jason, I'm going to have to cut this off because we're out of time. Fascinating conversation and one that I would love to engage in because nuclear fallout is far bigger than anything came out of Fukushima. But we're out of time. Peter Murphy of NOAA, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, sir.
And
appreciate the time.
Dave Gaudette, thank you.
You're welcome, Steve.
We'll be back
Pleasure.
To the subject on Talk of Alaska. Senator Begich is next week. Thanks to Dave Waldron, Josh Edge. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Every day, over 4,000 infants and toddlers go to sleep in child care programs across Alaska in unsafe cribs. The Alaska Community Foundation is partnering with THREAD to replace unsafe cribs in licensed child care programs across Alaska with new safe cribs. To help, donate today, and the Alaska Community Foundation will provide a one-to-one match of your donation. To donate, visit alaskacf.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create a second link between the Mat-Su and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.